So thanks a lot for the invitation here for to this interesting conference. I'm actually speaking also I'm replacing my friend and long years collaborator Günther Wolf, who couldn't come, and my title is slightly different than his title, which you see on the agenda, but my talk is a little bit more different from his talk than the difference in our titles. Anyhow, I am going to speak about the small x, diffraction and QCD, and I will show you results from Hera. So I will start with Hera. And I was told that by Matt that actually I should be fairly pedagogical, so I will start explaining what is Hera, what all this is. I mean, Hera is a large electron-proton collider. It has 6 kilometers circumference, and there is a proton ring and electron ring, and then these two rings collide basically in 2 points. There are 2 large experiments, H1 and Zeus, sitting here, and also an important experiment, Hermes. And I will speak here mainly about the results from H1 and Zeus, which are sitting here. This is a daisy site. This is Petra, you see, and actually this is under the town or under the park, big park, which is in the neighborhood of daisy site, which is somewhere here. And Hera, in Hera, what we collide is 27 GeV electron with 920 GeV protons, and we achieve 300 GeV central of mass energy. And this is very high energy for this electron-proton collision. It's roughly would correspond to 1,000 times slack, you know, shooting on the proton on rest. You see, this is the luminosity which we collected. It's not overwhelmingly high, but it is high enough already to do a lot of excellent physics. Of course, the luminosity is not so high as on the machine, where there is only one species of particle accelerated in both directions. It's much more difficult to accelerate proton and electron together and let them collide. Okay, this is the overview of the experiment. This is a picture of the event from H1 experiment. This is a picture of an event from the Zeus experiment. The electron is coming from this side, the proton is coming from this side. The experiments are fairly similar. They consist both of large central detectors. These are drift chambers in the beginning, which gives all these tracks, which allow to reconstruct the momenta of the particle, at least of the charged particle, and of the calorimeter. They differ mainly in the fact that the Zeus is a uranium scintillator calorimeter, which has different properties than the liquid argon calorimeter of H1. And now, from the position of the energy depositions, you see in these calorimeters, is basically the Q squared. This means the virtuality of the incoming photon. W, this is the center of mass of energy of the incoming photon-proton system. You see it here, this is the logo of the event, what is going on. The electron emits a photon, photon collides with the proton, and this is how it looks like. And you know, then the debris basically of this interaction here we see in the detector, and from this debris we reconstruct Q squares. This means the virtuality of the incoming photon W, the center of mass of energy, and X is the fraction of the proton momentum carried by this struck quark, and which is related to the Q square and W. Okay, now from the when we have this deposition of the energy and we collected the events, we actually can compute X and Q square, and we can compute this cross section, d sigma over dx dq square, and this is connected to the structure function in this way. And what is very important is actually that this expression is basically at Hera, at low X, completely dominated by F2. There are also other contributions which are very interesting, but in this talk I will just neglect them for clarity. So basically what we are reconstructing from this cross section is F2, and here you see the first picture of F2 which we took. This is a historic kind of a plot which was done, I think, already 10 years ago. This was the first measurement, and we immediately see that something is funny happening, because instead of being constant, as a lot of people expected, not all of them, though, it actually started to rise fairly fast. Now, in the infinite momentum frame, the interpretation of F2 is fairly straightforward because proton looks like a cloud of non-interacting quarks and gluons, and just this photon counts them. So it's just a kind of probabilistic interpretation which we get from the F2. This is in the first order true. This is how the data look like today. I mean, these are all the data, and you see which we have taken by the blue, this is H1 experiment, and red is Zeus, and you see that the data extend really fairly far down in the X variable, fairly far high up in Q square, in Q variable, here you see it, and it is, of course, here you see this point, this was where Slack was measuring roughly 30 years ago, you know. This is the measurement which was performed by Slack and then improved by NMC and several other experiments. So Hera really added considerable amount of data in this direction. So now the most important somehow results of this, maybe you see it here, this has this QCD fits which are performed to this data, and this QCD fits allowed basically to determine fairly well the gluon structure function. The gluon structure function is just we are getting to the gluon structure function through the evolution equation. This is a simplified evolution equation which I wrote down here, where only the one part is actually displayed, and the evolution equation is giving us somehow measuring how quickly the gluon structure function changes when Q square changes. And we see from this form that when we have the gluon structure function at some starting value, Q0 let's tell, then this kernel is shuffling the X variable from the high X to low X, and therefore we get this growth here. And the most important part is this kernel connected to the splitting of the gluon to gluon. This is basically the multiplication of the gluons which we observed here. So this growth is really basically due to the non-abelian structure of the QCD, and this is the dominant part. Because, for example, in the leading order Diglap, you see this PDG is given by this simple expression, and this 2 times CA is a fairly large constant. If there are quarks here somewhere, either we do not have 1 over Z, or this constant is much smaller, factor 6 almost smaller. So therefore, this is a dominant part in this multiplication of the gluon. So basically, all this growth, what you see here, is basically a gluon cloud. There is very little quarks inside this growth. There are some, but very small. So this is somehow the emanation of the non-abelian structure of QCD, if nothing else. And let me just remember you, since I am here, that the first somehow very important effect of this non-abelian structure of QCD was the asymptotic freedom. And this is the measurement which is made today, I mean 30 years later, which shows this asymptotic freedom very clearly. And you see here basically this open triangles. These are Hera data. They have very small errors, and they lie very nicely on the theoretical curve, which is fairly close to the original curve computed almost 30 years ago by Gross, Politra, and Wilczek. So, since this asymptotic freedom was completely crucial in establishing the QCD, there was another. I would like just to take a moment just to remember that there was another very important experiment in establishing QCD, which was done at Bayes in 1979. This was the experimental discovery of the gluon. And I was actually on this experiment, and I was responsible for getting out of the dust, you see, all these events. And we actually digged out a few hundred of these events, and they were very clean and very beautiful. And they've shown usually this two jet structure very cleanly. 90% of them were very clear two jets, but there was roughly speaking 10% which were definitely not two jets, like this one. And this was the discovery of gluon, and this was, of course, a very clean effect. So Tasso was basically the first experiment which saw it. But soon after Tasso, several other experiments were reporting similar results. Anyhow, the European Physical Society gave a prize for this discovery to the leaders of the Tasso experiment, Zöding, Wieck, and Wolf, and also to Cao Lan Wu, because she made the evaluation. So let me just come back now to Hera. This is diffractive, and come back that in addition to the usual non-diffractive events, as we call them, this means events in which the photon hits the proton and a proton burst into many particles, like this one here, and which we see in the detector like this, that we actually see a lot of particles in the forward direction. You see there is this forward calorimeters, as we call them. You see protons come from here and it bursts into many particles, and this forward calorimeters are lighting up. And this is kind of 90% of events have this lighting, but we have also 10%, and even as you will see larger, it's up to, at some Q-square, it's up to 20% of events where this is really not happening, where we do not have any deposition of energy. So we have very different type of topologies. Ones like this, where the particles are distributed along the pseudo-rapidity axis here, more or less uniformly, and one where you see there is nothing here, there is seen in the detector, there is just some energy in some region of pseudo-rapidity. And these events can be analyzed from in the best way, just to figure out whether this event is not a fluctuation of this type of the event. It's the best is just to look at the MX, this is the invariant marks of all particles seen in the central detector. And there is also another variable which can be, which is very important for diffraction. This is this T, momentum transfers to the diffractively scattered proton. And this variable can be measured in the so-called forward detectors, which are very much forward, 90 meters from the central detector roughly. They extend very much forward. They measure the deflection, the small deflection of the outgoing proton, and they see the proton itself. You see, so they see that proton actually was untouched and it is going forward, and we can measure the PT of this outgoing proton, you see, from this. So this are, so MX and this T are two very important variables. In some cases of diffractive scatter of the vector mesons, we actually do not need this forward detector to determine the T, but it's generally we need it. Okay. So now here you see the plot in logarithm mx squared, how the events are looking like at different W's, and you see they have very characteristic shape, basically that they look like a mountain here, and which falls down exponentially. It's a very clean exponential, which you see just we extend towards very small mx, and then we have a shoulder, or basically a plateau. And you see it all over, and this position of this mountain is just shifted by the energy, by a precise amount. So this is a very precise plot, and this is also a very precise exponential. And this is what we basically expect in diffraction and non-diffraction. And this is just this clean exponential is a sign that we have a non-uniform uncorrelated particle emission along the rapidity axis. And then, of course, if we, this is a probability to have a gap in such distribution. Okay, so now the very fact that we observe diffraction meant that something is strange, because you see, I mean, if you have a photon hitting a proton like here, it's very difficult to imagine that, you see, after it kicked out quite a lot of particle, yes, here, it's very difficult to imagine that it will remain intact. Yes, it's very difficult to see, and the best way to see that it is to actually that it's happening really is to think about this reaction in a little bit different way than in the infinite momentum frame, which is the usual way of thinking about the deep inelastic scattering. So in this in the slow proton frame, the incoming virtual photon actually fluctuates into the quark-antiquark pair, which in turn emits a cascade of the gluons like this, and this cascade of the gluon couples, you see, to the proton, basically. This is a picture which is much better, because then we get the total cross-section through the from the imaginary part of the elastic amplitude. This is the elastic amplitude, so this is just basically a cut here which we perform, and this is the total cross-section is connected to F2 through this relation. And then the rise of the total cross-section, or F2, with W, this means diminishing X. W is 1 over, X is Q square over W square. So rise of the total cross-section with W is a measure of radiation intensity. So the more gluons we have this rise. This is the picture in this frame. And here we have very naturally, we see how to connect diffraction to F2, because diffraction is similar to the elastic scattering. We just have to replace this outgoing photon by some diffractive state. This could be a Rho meson, or it could be J psi, or it could be any just two quark, you see, with some relatively small invariant mass. This is how diffraction will look like in this picture. And let me just tell you that this is really quite spectacular in this system, how it looks like, because you see this cloud here is very long. I mean, this pair lives for a long time at small x. This is a formula. It is living up to 1,000 Fermi. It's just up to 1,000 Fermi long. So it's many, roughly 100 nuclei radii for large nuclei. So this picture somehow was generalized to the dipole description of DIS, in which we just tell that the photon is fluctuating in the quark-antiquark pair, that this quark-antiquark pair, that the probability to have this quark-antiquark pair with a distance of, in space, some r, is given by the photon wave function, which is written here, that this quark-antiquark pair then interacts with the proton, with some cross-section, and then it annihilates again. This is here. You see, and then if we have the expression for the total cross-section, which is just a convolution of these probabilities of this photon wave function with this sigma qq, this means with the dipole cross-section, then we immediately can tell what is the cross-section for vector mesons. This is given by this expression, which is just basically the same as here. This is just by the optical theorem, but the outgoing wave function is changed to the vector meson wave function. And if we sum over all diffractive final state, which is should, you know, replace here this photon, then we get this simple expression in which basically we have this two-wave function as precisely as in this expression, but here we have a square. So we have very simple relation between the F2 diffractive cross-section for vector meson, which unfortunately requires a knowledge of the vector meson wave function, and the inclusive diffraction. This is this expression. Okay, these are just the pictures of this wave function, what we know about is how they extend in space. Just needless, I mean, that they have two characteristic regions. One is at small r, where these are basically this wave function determined by this Bessel function or MacDonald function K1, it is which is going one like 1 over epsilon r, and this gives rise to this famous relation Q square is roughly 1 over r square. This is what everybody knows. Somehow at large distances this wave function are determined by this large distance expansion of this K1, which is just given by the exponents of this epsilon times r, and epsilon has the mass of the quark inside. So at small q square is the mass of the quark, and this has to be, of course, a kind of constituent quark, determines how far this wave function extends. Okay, the breakthrough in Hera, one of the very important moments you see in the Hera physics was that this model, this dipole model, was proposed, and in addition to this wave function, which were known since long time, since 30 years, they were proposed already by Björken Kogut, I think 30 years ago. In this description is basically quite old. However, it was never taken very seriously, because we had no idea what is this dipole cross-section. And there was a few years ago, I mean 6 years ago, these two gentlemen actually propose a very simple form of this cross section, which actually describe, I will show it in a moment, describes the Terra data very well, where this cross section is just basically 1 minus exponents r square over 4 r zero square, where r zero square is basically given, it's kind of very simplified gluon wave function, which is, has a form x over x zero to the lambda, 1 over to the minus lambda. Okay, so this cross section has a very simple property that it is that it is scaling in r square over r zero square, and r zero is a function of x, and this is the origin of the geometrical scaling, which is widely used, you see, for explanation of heavy ion data today. And you see, from the fit to the data, the parameters of this model were fitted. They were just three parameters, and we got the sigma zero. This was the coefficient before. Then the power, which is lambda, which is 0.3, and this power, this is called this basically x saturation radius, which was around one. And you see here, this was also kind of historic plot, that the data were described fairly well. Of course, here is what is displayed, only data up to 35 GV Q square. So it's not so large, but at this time one could see that one can describe the data very well in both, you see, as a function of W square, as a function of Q square for for different Ws, and that this as a function of Q square, that this one is able to extend the data description down to very low Q squares, you see, where the model is not justified. I have to tell that, you know, this dipole description is really justified for larger Q square, and this transition here is just one just makes this transition, looks whether it fits, but it fits, you see. This was the finding. And as I said, I mean, in this picture already diffraction is immediately predicted, and this is a prediction for diffraction which was done later on, I mean, also many years ago. This was the first diffractive data, inclusive diffractive data, and you see that this is the absolute prediction that it fits. So therefore, you see, this is somehow, this connection diffraction is like a loop, and F2 is like a tree. So you see here basically this connection between the trees and loops immediately working in the Hera data. So we have here, this is the plot showing the geometrical scaling. This is just the Hera data plotted as a function of this tau variable, which is just Q square over a zero square. This is a property of the model, but you of course the model describes the data, and therefore you expect that it is like this. You see that the data should show this type of scaling, but it was really noticed by these people already a few years ago, and this gave also a lot of ideas to the people working on heavy ion data, how basically the how to interpret the heavy ion data. Okay, now the GBW model, which was really very important for many, cannot be somehow right, you see, because it has some obvious problem. First, the treatment of QCD evolution is only rudimentary. You know, the QCD evolution was basically described by this x over x0, this function r0 square, to some one power, you see, so it couldn't change with q square this power or something like this. This is not like the we are accustomed to think about evolution. So this was quite a problem of this model, but this was solved after years, that we could actually introduce, by modifying this function, we could introduce the Dirichlet into this expression, and actually it was working fairly well. This is a Dirichlet-like expression which replaces a zero square. Also, recently there was a BFKL motivated ansatz proposed by Yanku, Itakura, and Meunier, which shows that it is not necessarily the only way of fitting this data, of introducing the evolution. There may be many different ways. You see how the evolution can enter this type of expression. Now, this is one of the problems. This was this problem of the evolution, which was not properly tackled. There is another problem, was that actually it was really, this is a model which is having, where proton is really, it has no transverse dimension. It's all happening we integrate basically over all transverse dimensions. This is what is usually done in all analysis of the deep inelastic data. But if one has this type of picture where we have transverse dimension, R is a transverse dimension of the dipole, it's difficult to imagine that there is no somehow influence of difference between the size, you know, of the position of the dipole and the position of the protons. There should be something very clear dependence. And therefore, you see, I formulated when I stayed in at Brookhaven, Columbia, a year ago, with my collaborator Derek Tini, we formulated the impact parameter dependent model, where we modified, you know, this previous expression, just introducing the impact parameter dependence, and compare it to data. And you see, then one can very easily fix this impact parameter dependence just by looking, for example, at the J psi diffractive scattering. This means to look at the gamma star proton interaction going to J psi and proton. Proton should remain intact. Then we have very clean data on this, as you see it. And basically what you see here, this is a Fourier transform of this a proton shape. And from this picture, we can immediately read off the parameters of this exponential. You see, of this T of B is here. You see they are two different tries, but you see they do not differ very strongly. And also here, they do not have a big difference, you see, in description of the data, at least in the region where we see the data. Of course, later on, they would differ enormously. Now, this is the description, you see, of the data, and you see that actually it's very good. Now the data, these are recent data, the best data which we have, and then they extend here up to, you see, up to 150 GeV squared. So, and the chi-square and the quality of the description is really excellent. We get here somewhere, the chi-square is per degree 0.8, it's really very good. It was 1. Around 1.1, but it was on data which had much larger errors than this one. You see, on this data, it would be around 2.5. You see, so this is really much better as far as the chi-square is concerned. But, you know, at this time, we couldn't see it. It also, you know, it was only up to 30 GeV, and this is up to 150 GeV clocked. So this is... So this evolution really helps. This is mainly due to the evolution, that we introduced the evolution that we could improve the description. What you see, however, is something interesting, that we determine this lambda g here is fairly different. It is actually negative. In the GBW model, we actually had here plus 0.3. And here we have to start with a negative lambda. This means that we have kind of valence-like, as it's called now by the Durham people, are calling it valence-like gluon distribution. And there is no way of avoiding it in this scheme. I will come back to this problem later. Okay, here you see the comparison of this cross-section here and there. I don't want to go into this because this is maybe not so relevant to this audience. Here you see the very important thing. This is this rate of rise, you see, of the cross-section when x change or w change. You see, this is w squared to lambda tot, or 1 over x to lambda, and then you see here the lambda tot, and then you see that it rises. And what is very interesting. The Terra data starts here at this place. This is around the universal rate of rise of all hadronic cross section. So when Q square is very small, it's really like the hadronic cross section, and then it rises fairly large, but not so large as some people would like to have it, to 0.5. This is really not happening. This is the Lipat, so-called Lipatov rise. I will come back to this later on. And this is not happening, so it is a strong rise, but not so strong. So some people are telling that actually the what is unexpected in the Hera data is that the data is not so strongly rising as the Lipatov rise, and others are telling that Hera data are so special because they rise much faster than the universal rate of rise. So there were two schools of thinking about it. Okay, here you see this dipole cross section as a function of the impact parameter, and what you see is basically that here is the line you see where this cross section starts to be fairly large. This means you see it can be the maximum size of the cross section is basically 2 of this cross section. So it in the moment that it is coming over 1.25, this is kind of definition of what is called a saturation, and we are touching this cross section for dipoles of the size 3. This is roughly half of the Fermi, you see. So this is that if dipole has a size, you know, relatively small dipoles are actually starting to touch this line. And of course what you see is that, however, quite a lot of cross section is due to the tails, because if you compute the cross section, you will get it with a b square. So there is quite a lot of cross section is really outside of this central part of the proton. So if we would have a saturation, it would be only in the center of the proton, but not here. But quite a lot of cross section is really coming from out there. So this is a wave function times the cross section, dipole cross section. You see the spatial extension of the where the cross section is coming from, and you see that it is coming for light quarks. At large Q square, you know, it's very concentrated in the middle. For smaller Q square, it's still quite concentrated at small dipoles, but then it is for very small Q square like 1, it's really extending probably a little bit too far. This is, I don't think that this is realistic, but it is what is coming out. This is the same plot for the charm wave function, and you see that actually, you know, charm wave function is one of the wave function which is coming. You know, it's just that that the photon is splitting into charm, anti-charm, and you see here, and then you see that it gives you a fairly different picture, and this allows us immediately to make a prediction. You see for the F2 charm, this means that this is F2 when at least one charm particle is seen, and this model predicts immediately this F2 charm fairly precisely. So this is very nice and shows that actually the thing is working. Of course, it's basically all charm is here produced through the gluon structure function. There is in this model only gluon structure function, so the whole charm is derived from the gluon, and this is what is seen in the F2C, at least for low X. This is all low X data, it's not high X data. Here you see this picture which we see for vector mesons. Here we see that you see photoproduction data of Hera. This is only this one point. This is this usual hadronic rise. This is the same rise for Rho. However, when we have, for example, G-Psi, we have very quickly rising data. And you see this, of course, the errors are too large. But here, this is Psi 2S. You see, it's also very quickly rising. Phi is a little bit faster rising already. Here, this is a prediction of this dipole model. You see, this is a description of the J-Psi data. You see, it's fairly precise. The prediction is really fairly precise and very good. And of course, this Psi wave function is entering here. And you see here two different wave functions. So you see somehow the uncertainty of this type of description. If we would know the Psi wave function very well, then this data would be extremely predictive, because this is a very clean reaction. We have just this cloud of gluons which we should understand I mean, very well. And if we would have the Jape, we would know the Jape Saiwei function, we could use this. But that's the best what we can do. We just can have it. This is the extent, this is the transverse size of the proton, which we which we see in this reaction. We actually see this B. This is the transverse size of the proton, which we determine from the T distribution, and we see that it rises, but very gently. It rises basically from something like 3.8, something like this, here to 4.5, over fairly large change in W. So, and these are all very small sizes, because the usual proton from the Rosenfeld, Hofstetter experiment, from the Hofstetter experiment would be here. So this is the proton which we see, the size of this gluon cloud is smaller than the Hofstetter radius of the proton. Here you see the latest diffractive data, which is still not published. They are preliminary, they will be published very soon, and you see what is very interesting from data, that they are again show that the ratio between the diffractive and total cross-section is almost constant. All over here there is some deviation, but it is very constant basically all over, and from the property of the data quite a lot of information can be derived. I mean, what one is, of course, this ratio is constant, as I said. Then what we have here, this is an important information, how many what is the percentage of diffractive production, and we see that this is around 20% at Q square 2.7, and this is what is seen. We see already 20%, and we do not see the whole diffractive cross section, because we just can see only part. Of course, we hope that it's a fairly large part of the diffractive cross section, but it is not all. And this is already 20% at Q square of 2.7, and this is 10% at Q square of 2.27, and this is roughly what, this is quite precisely what we expect from the logarithmic decrease of this with Q square, you see. So this is just a logarithmic change, which we see here. Let me just see what I have. No. Okay, here let me just come to the absorptive correction of the two. If we have, you see, the fact that we observe diffraction, this means that this kind of loop diagram which enters, you see, in QCD this is a little bit toy diagram which I am drawing here, but we get the diffraction just cutting this diagram in this place. This is the main diagram, this is the main tree diagram QCD, and this diagram gives us something like 20% correction, and the sign between these two diagrams is negative, you see. So this diagram diminishes this diagram, this contribution, this usual single inclusive contribution. So it is diminishing it. And there is, according to this line, a new evaluation by Martin Riskin and Watt of diffractive data together. This is what you see here, is the latest diffractive data. This data which are not published, and they fit it with the type of Pomeroy structure function, and introduce here, you see, also this absorptive effect, you see, just subtracting the diffractive part which is entering in this F2 absorptive part, just from this equation. And what they find is actually that this absorptive effects are fairly important for the shape of the gluon distribution. This is a gluon distribution which in MRST I use. This is MRST, this is this full fit to all F2 data. This means Hera data, but also JPSI data and something. Also to JPSI data and and to the proton data, to and basically all jet data which we have. So this is a today's kind of standard QCD fit. I mean, one of the most worked out QCD fit. And this fit has a problem, that the gluon structure function becomes negative. This is because they allowed the gluon structure function to become negative. and it is doing it. And for example, in this dipole model, we had the gluon structure function, which is, was not negative. I mean, it couldn't be negative, of course, but it was going here to zero, like this. And they have even stronger effect. And what is happening if one introduces absorptive correction, that this is alleviated, I mean that it goes up, that this absorptive correction actually are changing this, I think, completely, I think, unphysical gluon structure function. It cannot go to zero. It's also in this dipole model, it cannot go here to zero, you see. It's impossible that we have no gluons at very at x equals zero, you see. This is what comes out from this dipole fit. And it is also coming from this very elaborated evolution fits of the MRST, even more stronger. And basically from all investigation which were done, this means CTEC and many others, you see everybody is getting a very strange gluon structure function which is going either to zero here or becoming negative. You see, and this absorptive correction according to MRST are really solving this problem. So you see that this absorptive correction are very important somehow in a understanding the data, but we are here really not at the end. Okay, let me just, I added because of today morning a few transparencies, so I hope that I have time to explain. This is, you see, what other effects can be expected if we have so many, so much diffraction here at HERA. Well, there is this, they are so-called AGK rules, which are telling us that if we cut, you know, that if we have a lot of contribution of this type of diagrams, we should have also other effects. This is, of course, a contribution to this diagram which we have a cut when we have a cut here. The diffraction is to have a cut in this place, but we can have a cut in this place. This is so-called one cut. This is also one cut, but we can also cut it in this place, this type of diagram, and then we would cut in the same type two pomerons, such a ladder. You see, it's called a pomeron. This is just a name in this moment. This is what we. So we have these two cuts. We can also have the two cuts, and this is the probability which we have. You see, to get what is the relation between one cut, two cuts, and three cuts. You see, if we have m pomerons. You see, so this is known in some in very simple situation. We can evaluate this in a very simple way. For example, in this dipole model, it can be evaluated. Okay, let me just show. This is what is the physical meaning of this. If we cut here, this is diffraction, then we see only very few particles even. Of course, if we cut in this place, you see, so this is one cut, then we see the usual kind of F2 distribution where a lot of particles inside the detector. But if we cut two ladders in the same time, we should actually see, at least approximately, it is very naive, but we should see higher multiplicity. I mean, basically here it would be factor two higher, but this cannot happen because of the energy momentum conservation. We cut, though, two pomerons, but we do not have two times the energy, so we cannot produce twice as many particles. But there should be some increase in multiplicity because of this. This is, in the moment, we are focusing on this, I mean. However, you see, we may have also many other, you see, this is three pomeron diagrams, and here you see more loops, you see, this is today, you see, when Zvi Bern was discussing, you know, how many Feynman diagrams you can have. I remember that I have it. You see that we were also looking how many, this is three pomerons. If we have five pomerons, we have 1,000 diagrams like this. And here is the contribution which we evaluate from our data, you see, how many pomerons we actually can contribute, cut through how many pomerons should contribute to HERA data. And you see the F2 is usually around 1, and if we cut through 5 pomerons from this evaluation, this is basically fit to HERA data, we still have a 0.5%. It's 0.5% of the effect. This means this is quite a lot of events, you see, which have should have a cut through 5 pomerons in simultaneous cut. So you see how important it is. Now if we extend this to LHC, then there will be many more pomerons which will be simultaneously cut. Yes? Then you will have these millions of diagrams, which was discussed here in the morning. You see? Okay, problem, I was just talking here that there is this problem of Diglap and QCD fits to F2, and that we have this problem with this valence like gluon structure function. I'm just finishing. And that there is the remedy is absorptive correction or a different evolution. You see, there are many possibilities how this problem of the gluon structure function can be solved. One is really what I was, you know, describing. The another is, you see, to change the evolution equation. And I will not describe it because I do not have time, but I will just show you that the evolution equation is actually driven by this is driven by this PGG, and this PGG, this is the probability to emit a gluon, is just basically a constant in the Diglap, but it is very different in this low X region when we perform the full is very different in the low X region where we when we perform a full X resummation. And then you see this is this Lipatov, so-called Lipatov rise, which I was showing at the beginning, and this as a first order correction, and next to leading order correction in this Lipatov-like evaluation, and you see that they are very different. So somehow they all, and of course, you see they are both, these two lines are completely incompatible with data. Data are compatible with something which is fairly similar, so there is quite a lot of effort in the last time to get a better evolution, and this is the outcome of this, and so it may happen. Let me just go now, skip, and go to the conclusion. And so we are, I went through the HERA data and I was showing that we are developing a very good understanding of inclusive and diffractive photon-proton interaction. That observation of diffraction indicates multi-gluon interaction effects at HERA, and that we have several open problems, that we have valence like gluon density. I think that this is a quite important problem, that we have definitely important absorptive correction, and that we probably have a different low X QCD evolution. And so let me just finish with this. Okay, thank you.
We have time for just a few quick questions. Yes?
I haven't quite well understood. When you measure diffractive dissociation and also structure function small x, then you extract the parameters for your Pomeron. So do you see QCD Pomeron, Lipatov Pomeron, or do you rather see phenomenological Pomeron?
No, we do not see a Lipatov Pomeron. I try to make it quite clearly. I mean, in the GBW model, Lipatov Pomeron has 1 over x to 0.5, yes?
Yes.
And in the GBW model, you have 1 over x to 0.3. So this is not a Lipatov Pomeron. In this, if we introduce a Diglap evolution, we have a changing. This lambda is changing, and it starts at small scale with minus sign. I mean, it's negative even. You see, this means it seems, you know, it's negative,
so
and then it is changing, but it is never going to up to the Lipatov value.
Okay, but do you see phenomenological Pomeron? There is phenomenological Pomeron with residual alpha p of 0, well, 0.07 or something. Do you see that?
It will, no, it's not going to 0.7. This power is never becoming so high.
0.07.
Oh, you mean 0.07?
That's phenomenological.
This is what we see. I mean, as I was, you know, this power is becoming the usual at low Q squares. You see, at HERA we have this usual phenomenological Pomeron, the standard Pomeron.
Okay, so this rounds. Okay, thanks.
This is really the case.
Okay, one more, two more quick questions.
When you discuss the dependence of the dipole cross-section on the impact parameter, you introduce this profile function T of B. Have you considered making it dependent on the dipole size?
PGG.
No, T of B. You had a profile function, right, for this gluon distribution?
Yes, we considered this. This is an important. We looked into this. This, you know, it's a full talk on this. Yes. I can tell you later on what is the outcome.
Comments, Dan?
I think it's worthwhile saying that the usual interpretation of this data in terms of the quark-parton model, we use the infant momentum frame or the standard parton model frame, and you just think you're striking a quark or out of a gluon or whatever, doesn't work anymore, because this work I did with Hoyer and company is that you have to consider rescattering. And the gluon rescattering totally changes your impression of actually what you're studying. It's yeah. not this usual idea where you have a parton distribution computed from wave functions, and that's what you measure anymore. Because this rescattering actually causes diffraction, absorption, single spin asymmetries, and all the rest. So actually we're appreciating now that the usual picture that we use is really, in fact, not adequate. We have to really... And you have to reinterpret it all in terms of rescattering corrections now. You cannot ignore the final state interactions of the quark.
No, I fully agree.
Yeah, but it looks like you're playing Podesta particle expansion still.
No,
I don't know. Okay. So, okay, it's just a comment.
We need to move on. Let's thank the speaker once again.